and welcome to Dog Talk with Dr. Jen. I'm Jennifer Summerfield, a veterinarian and professional dog trainer. Join me every episode for handy tips on training and dog behavior to help you better understand your best friend. Hi, guys, and welcome to today's episode of Dog Talk with Dr. Jen. Today, we are going to be talking some more about unwanted barking issues in dogs, so specifically about dogs who bark at things in public, as a follow-up to last time when we talked about dogs who tend to get wound up and bark at things when they're inside the house at home. So should be a good topic, and I'm definitely excited to get into some nitty-gritty details about that with you guys today. Now, before we jump into our topic today, I did want to go ahead and mention that I am excited to announce I'm going to be teaching a 6-week class online starting in December through the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy on abnormal behavior issues in dogs. So basically focusing on things like, fear and anxiety issues, different types of aggression, compulsive behavior issues, all that kind of stuff. So just wanted to mention it. If it's something that interests you and something that you, would like to spend a few weeks learning more about, you'll be able to find more information about that on my blog as it gets closer to time. But you can also go anytime to FenziDogSportsAcademy.com and, take a look at their class schedule and you'll see the all the information about it there. Registration for that won't open until November 22nd, so you've got quite a bit of time yet, and we should have at least one or two more podcast episodes between now and then, so I'll try to make sure and remind you when I do those as well. But in the meantime, just wanted to go ahead and mention it. If anybody does have questions about that course as far as, what kinds of things we'll be talking about or anything else along those lines, feel free to shoot me an email, jen@drjensdogblog.com. Happy to talk to you about it. And hopefully I will get to see some of you guys there, figuratively speaking. So now, without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into today's topic. So what we're going to be talking about today is dogs who bark at things out in public, as opposed to dogs who bark at things inside the house. And what I'm picturing here, so that you kind of have an idea of where we're going with this is your typical dog who has a lot of trouble doing things like just going out for a walk in the neighborhood or, going to the park, things like that, because they just cannot handle seeing, usually it's either other dogs or strange people or sometimes both. So it's a really difficult behavior to live with in a lot of ways, as I'm sure you know if you've ever had this experience. It definitely makes it hard to do the kinds of things that most dog owners take for granted about their dogs, just being able to take them out for potty breaks or being able to, walk them around the block, things like that, without having their dog cause a scene. So this problem, you'll hear it called leash reactivity a lot. And the reason for that is that most dogs who have this issue tend to have it specifically when they're on leash in public. So often if the dog is loose for some reason, not that we recommend that, of course, in a public places for the most part, but often owners will have noticed that if for some reason the dog's loose, they don't tend to react so much that way. It tends to be something that's pretty specific to the dog being on leash. So that's why a lot of times you'll hear it called leash reactivity. So, the big question before we delve into specifics of how we approach this problem and how we treat it is, why in the world do dogs do this, right? I think that's a great question. I think it's a question that most owners have, who have a dog that has this problem, because to us, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, right? It seems like they're clearly really overreacting to things, that just shouldn't be a big deal, and we can't understand why they're doing this. So the most common reason that dogs do this, at least in my experience with the population of dogs that I see, is because they are fearful, right? They are afraid or anxious or uncomfortable about what they're seeing. So meaning either they're fearful and uncomfortable about dogs, seeing other dogs, or they're fearful of strangers or not very comfortable around strangers or not sure how they feel about strangers. And this kind of barking, growling, lunging, hackles up, crazy Cujo-looking kind of behavior is their way of responding to that fear. So we all know the saying that the best defense is a good offense, right? And that's kind of the motto of, your typical leash reactive dog. So these behaviors, you know, if we're talking about them in scientific terms, you know, things like barking, growling, lunging, you know, showing teeth, those types of, you know, scary looking behaviors are called distance increasing behaviors because that is the goal behind them, right? So basically dogs who do this towards other dogs or towards people they see are doing their best to, you know, make this thing that's scaring them go away. And the big reason that a lot of these guys do this on leash, but not necessarily at other times, is that the leash kind of limits their options, right? So a lot of these dogs, if they weren't on leash, they could just choose to leave the situation if they wanted to, right? If they saw a dog at the end of the block and they were nervous about it, they could just turn around and go the other way. When they're on leash, they don't have that option. And they know that, you know, and obviously most dogs have a lot of experience being walked on leash by the time they're very old at all. So they are always aware in the back of their mind when they're on leash that they don't really have the option to just leave the situation. And that's why you tend to see a lot of these more forwardly aggressive displays, you know, because they kind of feel like that's the only thing they can do. You know, if you're having a fight or flight response and flight isn't an option, then, you know, you don't really have any other options. You kind of fall back on fight. And as far as why it happens, there, you know, can be a few different reasons. Obviously, we could do a whole 30-minute discussion sometime on that topic alone. But basically, you know, this can be because the dog is, you know, has some genetic tendencies towards being fearful and, you know, not tolerating new things, you know, new people or new dogs very well. It could be because they weren't very well socialized when they were a puppy, which I know we talked more about that in one of my previous episodes as far as what that means, you know, what the socialization period is in puppies, and what some of the consequences can be if they don't really get exposed to things that they're going to encounter in the world at that age. So one of the consequences can be something like this, where basically they react to, you know, seeing people or seeing dogs, you know, by becoming really upset about that instead of just taking it in stride. Or it can be a result of having some past experiences that weren't so great, right? So sometimes this type of behavior will develop in a dog. For example, if, you know, it's been attacked by another dog at some point in the past, some dogs, you know, have a history of being fine on walks until one day they were walking down the street and a, you know, big dog came charging out of a neighbor's yard and attacked them. And, you know, then the owner says ever since then, they've been really reactive towards other dogs when they go for walks. And that's understandable from, you know, the dog's perspective. Before we delve into all the details about treating fear-related leash reactivity, I do want to mention there are definitely some cases that don't fall under this umbrella of, you know, dogs who are fearful, and we'll kind of circle back around and address that at the end of our discussion. So if you're thinking in the back of your mind, but wait, I don't think that's my dog's problem, hold on to that thought because we'll get there. But because most of the dogs that I see with this issue are fearful, that's what we're going to spend most of our time today talking about. So just like we did with our barking at things part one discussion last time, we are going to talk a little bit about both management options for this problem, as well as how we go about treating it from a training standpoint. So management first, right? And the reasons that we care about this are the same as the reasons we talked about last time. So basically, there are two big ones. And the first one is that obviously, if you can manage the problem outside of the times that you're actively working on it, it's going to make your life a lot better, right? Nobody likes walking a dog who is constantly barking and lunging at things the whole walk. You know, it's stressful, it's embarrassing, it's, you know, it's definitely not a nice, peaceful, relaxing walk for you or your dog. So the more we can avoid having that happen or find ways around it or find ways for you to be able to walk your dog peacefully while we're working on the problem, you know, that's just going to make everybody's quality of life much better. So definitely worth it from that standpoint. The other big reason, which is really important when it comes to our training plan, is again the same reason we talked about last time, which is we really, really, really do not want your dog to keep rehearsing this behavior sequence every time you take him for a walk, right? Because the more he does it, the more it's going to be hard to teach a different response going forward. So for those reasons, every time I see a dog for this problem for a behavior consultation, the first thing we always talk about is what can we do from a management perspective starting today to make sure that this doesn't continue to just happen constantly on a daily basis. So the biggest thing management-wise that you can do in most situations is find some either some quiet places or some times of the day when you can walk your dog where you're really unlikely to encounter other people or other dogs, you know, whichever one it is or both that your dog has trouble with. So this might mean, for example, things like changing your daily routine around a little bit. So maybe instead of walking your dog when you get home from work at 5 o'clock, when all of your neighbors are also out walking their dogs, maybe, you know, get up early in the morning and take your dog for a walk, you know, at 6:30 a.m. before you leave for work. So obviously that wouldn't be, you know, something I'd be excited about personally. I'm not much of a morning person, so totally understand when people tell me that's kind of a hardship. But, you know, things like that are definitely options, because oftentimes walking your dog early in the morning or really late at night, you're going to be less likely to run into other people who are also walking their dogs, or, you know, things like kids coming home from school or kids outside playing or neighbors outside mowing their lawn, you know, depending on what your dog's triggers are. Obviously, that's going to influence, you know, specifically what times might be better or what things you're trying to avoid. But oftentimes, just by making some basic schedule changes like that, that makes a big difference. The other option, especially if you live in an area that's kind of close quarters with your neighbors, so whether that's like an apartment complex or it's a neighborhood kind of in town, like where I live in Huntington, there are a lot of areas where the houses are pretty close together. So, you know, if you were going to just walk out your front door and take your dog for a walk in your neighborhood, very likely that you're going to encounter quite a few other people and potentially other dogs at fairly close quarters during your walk. So if you have a dog that can't really handle that, one option when you need to walk them each day is, you know, maybe you could put them in the car and find some place within a 5 or 10 minute drive, right, that you could take them and go for a walk there that's going to be a lot quieter and less populated. So maybe there's a walking trail in your area, or maybe there's another, you know, like a subdivision, a more suburban area that you know of where the houses are more spread out and, you know, there aren't as many people with dogs, you know, what have you. The specifics of that are going to vary a little bit depending on where you live. But oftentimes with a little bit of creative thinking, you can come up with some place you could take your dog to go for walks that is going to be a lot less stressful for both of you than trying to walk in your neighborhood, at least in the beginning while you're trying to get a handle on the problem. The other thing that I've found that works well for a lot of my clients, not all of them, because it does depend somewhat on the dog, but for many dogs, using a head halter when you walk them can be really helpful for this problem. It really, what I like about head halters, and I know that they're a little bit controversial, not everybody likes them that much, and I don't like them for every dog, but what I like about them for the dogs that they do work well for is that they give you really good physical control of the dog. So even if your dog is really big and you're, you know, not a very big, strong person, you have really good control of their head so that they just kind of physically can't bark and lunge the way that they can on, you know, a harness or a regular buckle collar. So if you've never seen a head halter and you can't really picture what that might look like, it's basically like a halter for a horse, but, you know, size down for a dog, if that makes sense. So it has a strap that goes over the dog's nose and a strap that goes behind their ears, and the leash attaches, at least with most designs, under the dog's chin. So once you have that on, you have control of their head, and they really can't, they can't lunge very well. They can't really lean their whole body weight into something like a collar to pull you. So it, particularly for dogs who get really wound up and want to like lunge and throw themselves at things, it can be a really good way of immediately getting a lot more control over them without resorting to something that works by hurting them or choking them, you know, causing pain, anything like that. So the downsides of head collars or head halters, you know, they're you'll hear both terms, are that they do tend to take some desensitization up front to teach the dog to get used to them, meaning that you're going to have to spend a little bit of time in most cases with some treats, just teaching your dog to be comfortable wearing the head halter, because the mistake a lot of people make is they just kind of throw it on their dog and say, okay, let's go for a walk. And frequently the dog hates it if they haven't been introduced to it. So most dogs actually can learn to wear a head halter comfortably if you take a little bit of time up front to teach them and make it a positive experience. You know, the details of how we might do that are a little bit beyond the scope of what we're talking about today, but we can always get into that in a future episode or on the blog if it's something people are interested in. But for many dogs, if you take a little time to do that up front, it can be a great tool. Now, I do say not all dogs, because I have absolutely had some some, you know, behavior patients who, no matter how much work we did with the head halter, they just really did not like wearing it. You know, and sometimes you just end up deciding to cut your losses and say, you know, I don't know if this is going to be a great tool for this particular dog, and that's okay. The other sort of caveat I'll give you about head halters in general is you do have to be careful, obviously, if your dog has kind of a long leash and if they are able to get a head of steam up and have some momentum and hit the end of that leash really hard. Wearing a head halter, we would worry about, you know, the possibility of a neck injury or something like that if their head gets, you know, wrenched around really sort of suddenly like that with a lot of force behind it. So I do always tell my clients, if you're going to use a head halter, use it with a relatively short leash. So usually not longer than a 4-foot leash. And I normally have my hand on the leash partway down anyway if we're walking in a head halter. So the dog really doesn't have any opportunity to get up that kind of momentum or speed where they might hurt themselves. So certainly you'd never want to use one with like a long line or a retractable leash or anything like that. What I don't recommend using for these guys, if you can possibly help it, is anything that is going to cause pain or, you know, choke the dog or cause, you know, some kind of painful or physically uncomfortable reaction when they lunge. So things like prong collars or choke collars, you know, are unfortunately kind of common with this problem. And I totally understand why you might reach for something like that, because I know how it is to feel like you just need some better control of your dog. The downsides of those kind of tools, even if we're not specifically using them in a training program, like even if we're not saying, well, you need to correct your dog with the prong collar or the choke collar every time they lunge, is that every time the dog does, you know, try to pull or lunge on those types of training tools, it hurts. Right? Because that's, you know, unfortunately what they're designed to do. And the risk you run into with that is that many dogs will learn to associate that pain or that discomfort that they feel when they lunge with the presence of the other dog or the presence of a person, something like that. So actually over time, that can make this problem a lot worse, because as you'll see when we get into our training section here in just a second, that's kind of the opposite of what we're trying to accomplish with our training plan. So for that reason, I do always tell my clients, if we can possibly avoid tools like that, that's strongly recommended. You know, certainly something like a head halter is going to be much less of an issue as far as those types of problems go. Or in a pinch, I'd rather see the dog in, you know, a harness of some kind or even a flat buckle collar, unless the owner just physically can't hold on to the dog without some other type of equipment. So with that in mind, once you've got your management strategies in place, whatever they might be specifically for your particular dog, we can kind of move on and start thinking about training. So that means, how are we going to address this problem with the goal of actually changing the dog's behavior in the future going forward? So in terms of the general approach for this issue, we are trying to accomplish two things. So the first one, remember, we're talking here specifically about dogs who do this because they're fearful or, you know, uncomfortable or anxious for some reason about seeing other dogs or seeing people. So the first thing we're trying to accomplish is we want to change the way the dog feels about seeing dogs, seeing people, seeing whatever their triggers are. So we actually want to change that underlying emotion. And that, honestly, is the most important part of the plan for these guys, because ultimately that's what fixes it. Because once we've taught the dog that there's no need to, you know, to be afraid or to be upset when they see these things, then the barking, lunging, growling, all that kind of behavior disappears because the dog doesn't have any reason to do it anymore. So that's really important. And we're going to talk in more detail about specifically how we accomplish that here over the next few minutes. But do keep in the back of your mind that that is our ultimate goal with all of this. So the second thing that we want to work on with our training, in addition to changing the dog's fear, you know, the emotion that they're feeling about the trigger, is we also would like to teach the dog to do something else when they see their trigger. So just for the purposes of making our discussion a little bit simpler here, we're going to focus on dogs who, you know, let's say bark and lunge at other dogs specifically, but just be aware that if your dog has different triggers, you know, this discussion still applies to them. You know, just substitute that trigger whenever I say another dog. So for most of these guys, we do want to teach them to do something else when they see another dog rather than barking and lunging. And, you know, this is something that, depending on, you know, who you talk to or who you work with, you may run into some slightly different opinions about that, which is totally fine. And I agree that our major goal with these dogs that are fearful is to change that emotional response. So technically speaking, if you do that, the behavior will resolve and you don't actually have to specifically go out of your way to teach an alternative behavior. For me personally, I prefer to just go ahead and teach another behavior anyway, because it's really easy to do that at the same time that you're addressing the fear response. And I find that it's a little bit easier for owners to grasp a lot of times, you know, as far as having a sort of specific picture in mind for what it is that we want the dog to do. So for me personally, I'm trying to do both of those things with these guys. I'm trying to change how they feel about their triggers, and I'm also trying to teach them an alternative behavior that I want them to do when they see another dog. So rather than bark and lunge and go crazy, I want you to do this and get a reward for it. So when we work with these guys, first thing that we want to teach them is to associate seeing another dog with getting something fabulous. You know, this is just classical conditioning in a nutshell. We want them to associate the trigger with, oh my gosh, something great just happened. So for most dogs, one of the easiest ways to do that is to use food, right? Because dogs, at least most dogs, naturally get pretty excited about treats or, you know, other types of really tasty food rewards, and they're really convenient to use, right? They're easy to carry around in our pockets. We have really good control over when our dog gets them and when they don't. It's really easy to get our timing right with them. So there's a lot of just practical reasons that food rewards tend to work really well for this. So for me, that tends to be my go-to. That's true for many trainers. It's not the only approach, and we'll mention a little bit more about that as we go along as well. But we're mainly going to be talking about using food rewards for our purposes today. So when you do this, the first key is you have to start at a distance from the other dog where your dog can be successful. I can't emphasize that enough. Guys, that is super important to success here. So if your dog doesn't like other dogs and they see a dog, they start barking and lunging right away, that's not going to work. You've got to start your training plan at a distance far enough away from that dog that they can see it and notice it but not get upset. And how far away that is depends totally on the dog. So I've worked with some dogs who, you know, being a block away is plenty. They can do it. I've worked with some dogs who can do it as long as the other dog's across the street, but if they're on the same side of the street, it's too much. And I've worked with dogs who were so sensitive that we had to go like find a big field to work in and have the other dog, you know, all the way on the other side of the field, like so that you could barely tell there was another dog over there before they could handle it. So some dogs need a lot of distance, and that's okay. But that's your first goal before you do anything else, is you have to find a distance to work with your dog at where they're able to see the other dog, be aware that it's there, but not immediately get upset. Then what you're going to do is, as soon as your dog notices the other dog, you're going to tell them how awesome they are. You're going to give them a reward. So ideally, for this to work sort of the best that it can, it's nice if you can use a clicker. You can use a specific verbal marker. Like if I don't have a clicker handy, I'll say yes and give the treat. And that's what I use as a verbal. And the advantage of doing that is just that it lets you mark that moment a little bit more specifically when your dog actually sees the other dog. You can click, or you can, you know, say your verbal marker. But in a pinch, even just praising your dog, saying, hey, what a good dog, and giving a treat, it'll still work. It may just take a little longer for your dog to catch on. So every time your dog looks at the other dog, you're going to praise them and give them a treat. And that's step one. So you just do that as many times as you need to until your dogs are ready to move on, which we'll talk about in a minute. So there are no strings attached for this treat. Your dog doesn't have to do anything in particular. It's literally just as soon as your dog sees the dog, you say, what a good dog, or yes, or use your clicker, whichever, and you give them a treat. So what happens after you do that a few times, and how long it takes for your dog to catch on, just depends on your dog. You know, so most dogs get this figured out within the first session. You know, when I work with dogs at our training center or at people's homes, but sometimes it takes a little bit longer, and that's okay. But basically, you do that until your dog starts to realize, hey, every time I look at this other dog, I get a treat for that. That's pretty cool. So that's important, right? Because that's how we change the dog's emotion. We want the dog to learn, I see this other dog, I get food. Once they've made that association, they start to feel really differently about that other dog, because now it's not something scary that they want to avoid. It's something that actually is a good thing for them to see, right? And when they start to get this, you'll see their body language change. So when they first notice another dog, instead of immediately kind of their ears going forward and getting tense and, you know, leaning forward and all the things that they do as kind of a prelude to exploding and barking and lunging, they will kind of perk up. You know, their tail will come up and they'll look, you know, like, oh, it's another dog, and they'll turn and look at you. So when that happens, that's perfect. you know, give your dog a big jackpot the first time you see that, because that's exactly what we want. So once they're able to do that, then we shift what we're rewarding just a little bit. And instead of doing the praise and reward as soon as your dog sees the other dog, we let your dog see the other dog and we wait for them to choose to look back at you for their treat. And then you praise or you click and you reward. And for most of the dogs that I work with, that's kind of our end goal behavior. That's what we want them to do when they see another dog. So once this is really well trained, when their owners are walking them out in the neighborhood, what happens if they see a dog across the street is instead of, you know, barking and lunging at it, they see the dog, they go, oh, there's a dog. They look up at their owner, they get a treat, and then they just keep on walking. So that's kind of what the finished product looks like. Now, this is different from just teaching your dog a watch me cue, right? And I did want to address that because I think that feels really similar to a lot of people. And certainly it can look like the same thing at first glance, but it's not. And that's really important. I don't recommend just teaching these dogs, you know, a cue like watch me, for example, that means look at me and keep looking at me until I release you, as a way of dealing with reactivity issues, because there is a huge, huge difference between you telling your dog, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at that scary thing over there, look at me, versus your dog seeing the scary thing, or the thing hopefully that used to be scary but now isn't, acknowledging it, and then choosing to look back at you when they're comfortable. So two totally different things, guys, even though the behavior looks really very much the same. Oftentimes, if you're trying to kind of force your dog to look at you, and I know I say force kind of in quotation marks, because you certainly can train this positively with treats, so it can feel like, well, how am I forcing my dog to look at me? But if you are cueing it and insisting on it, when your dog would rather be looking at the scary thing they're worried about across the street, that's still not what we're looking for. Because a lot of times that can actually make your dog more nervous, right? And you can kind of imagine that if you were in a room with a spider, you know, or something that you were afraid of, you know, you want to keep your eye on it, right? You're worried about the spider. You want to make sure you see where it is. You want to make sure it's not getting too close or it's about to crawl up your leg. So if you have, you know, somebody sitting next to you in the room that says, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at that spider, just look at me, don't look at it. Does that make you feel better? Or does it make you feel more nervous about where the spider is, right? So I think most of us can relate to that. And dogs are the same way. If there's something in the environment that your dog is nervous about, I do not think it is valuable to insist that they not look at it, right? Because that tends to just make them more worried about it. So instead, what we want them to do is I want my dogs to know, like, yes, look at it. You know, of course, you can look at it as much as you want. That's totally fine. Every time you look at it and choose to look back at me, you're going to get a reward. But you can absolutely look at it. So I'm never going to stop a dog from doing that I'm working with. That way they can look, they can choose to look back. And sometimes, you know, they may choose to look for a few seconds before they look back. And that's okay. You know, as long as I can tell from their body language that they're not about to lose their mind. If they want to look and watch it for a minute before they feel comfortable turning back to me for their treat, that's totally fine. And honestly, guys, you'll see a huge difference in how comfortable the dog is just from that little shift, just from giving them the choice to look at it and then look back at you when they're ready, rather than you kind of forcing them, watch me, watch me, watch me, don't look at that. So that is an important distinction that I wanted to make. So troubleshooting. Very, very often, when I see clients for the first time who are having this problem with their dogs, and I start to explain what the plan is, they tell me, oh, you know, that won't work with my dog because, you know, I've tried using treats and she won't take them when she gets upset. Right? So I would venture to say that almost every client I've ever worked with for leash reactivity has brought that up at some point. So really common, and not at all an impediment to the plan working, so don't worry. So in most cases, what's happening here, if your dog is not taking treats, is you're too close. So it's very normal for dogs to not be interested in treats when they're in the throes of being super wound up and upset about something, right? So if your dog is already hitting the end of the leash and barking and lunging and their hackles are up and their eyes are all wide and bugged out and they're losing their mind, then no, you know, they're not going to be interested in a hot dog slice or, you know, a piece of cheese that you're trying to give them, because we're past that point. So if that's happening, that's information for you. And it tells you whatever distance you're at from that other dog, it's way too close. You need to be a lot further away. And I do find that a lot of times that's hard to achieve, right, in real life, because for a lot of owners, if their dog's distance that they can manage is, you know, it's more than a block or it's more than two blocks, you know, or it's just going to depend on what their living environment is and, you know, how close or how far away they tend to see other dogs when they just encounter them in real life. Oftentimes, every time they see another dog on a walk, it's too close, you know, so they never even get a chance to try to work with their dog at that level where they could handle it. So if your dog is sensitive enough that that's the problem, then it's hugely valuable to get in touch with a good trainer in your area who works with leash reactivity, who can help you set up some controlled training sessions to work on it. And I find that that is really helpful for a lot of my clients that have this problem. With a lot of them, we do at least our first few sessions out at our training facility where we can have a helper dog, right? Like usually I'll use one of my dogs who, you know, is really calm and easygoing and doesn't get upset about other dogs at all. And I can have one of our, you know, staff members help us for 5 or 10 minutes and they'll take my dog and, you know, we can have them stand as far away from us as we need them to. We can have them move or not move. We can have them pick up the dog and hold him if they need to do that to make it less worrisome for the other dog. So we have all these factors. Distance is the biggest one, but there are a lot of other factors we can manipulate to find a starting point where the dog can handle it. And once we do that, and we start to make some headway and the dog starts to learn the game, like, oh, you know, I look at this dog, I get treats. That's a pretty good deal. Then from there, we can start to make it harder. And at some point we get to the level where, oh, you know, now this dog has gotten to the point where they can handle seeing another dog, you know, maybe a block away. And then the owner can start to do some work in their neighborhood at that point. So that's really common. So don't feel like if you've kind of tried using treats and your dog hasn't been interested in them, don't feel like, well, you know, this plan won't work. In most cases, the problem is just that you've been too close. Now, there certainly are dogs who are just not very food motivated. A lot of times I find like Huskies and some of the Northern breeds like that, it's very hard to find food that they're interested enough in that it'll work for this kind of a training plan where it needs to be something not only that they're willing to eat, but hopefully something that they get kind of excited about. So yeah, if your dog falls into that category, or if you're just interested in other strategies, it's absolutely not necessary to use food for this. You can use other types of, you know, rewards or things that make your dogs happy, or things that make your dog happy. So something like play, for example. And this takes a little more finesse and a little more nuance. So it can be harder to do by yourself, you know, without somebody kind of walking through it with you and helping you. But I did want to mention it is a thing. So if that's something you're interested in, you can definitely do a little more research on that. I'll tell you, one of the main people I know of who uses that approach more is a behaviorist named Dr. Amy Cook, who lives out on the West Coast. But she, that's kind of the biggest thing that she does is she works with reactive dogs, but she doesn't tend to use food so much. She tends to use play, like personal play, social play, that kind of thing. And, you know, it works fabulously. So that's an option too. And I did want to just kind of mention that. I'll put a link to Amy's website when I do the show notes for today's episode, just in case that's something you're interested in learning more about, because it's absolutely a viable strategy also. So the other common thing I see in terms of a, you know, mistake or a, you know, something that's causing people to have trouble making progress is I see people who are on the right track and they're trying to do this, but they are constantly working their dog at a level where the dog is able to eat and they're maybe not completely losing their mind, but they're still pretty tense and upset. So we talk a lot about thresholds when we talk about working with leash reactive dogs. So, you know, you'll hear trainers say, oh, well, the dog needs to be below threshold, you know. And what we mean when we say that is the dog needs to be calm, basically. They need to be at that emotional level where they can notice the other dog and go, oh, you know, there's a dog over there. I think I get treats for that. But they're not upset. So if you're working above that level, meaning people will say, you know, you have your dog over threshold, then that's where, you know, your dog's barking, lunging at the end of the leash, won't take treats, anything like that. So that's pretty clear, right? You know, that obviously you're probably not going to get a lot of improvement if you're trying to work with your dog in that state all the time. But there is this kind of in-between gray area where I think it's sometimes hard for owners to read whether their dog's learning or not, you know, where the dog is like, well, they're taking food, but They're definitely not relaxed. You know, they're kind of right on the edge of losing it. It's like they're just holding on by their fingernails, you know? So really important that we not work dogs in that state either. So that doesn't really count as being, you know, below threshold or being at a level where your dog's able to learn. Because even if your dog's taking food, if they're really tense and you can tell, you know, they're every time they take a treat, they snap their head straight back around to stare at the dog and they're kind of almost on the edge of growling and their ears are up and they're staring and they, you know, can't turn around voluntarily to look at you, things like that. That's not really a level that's very conducive to learning either. So again, the answer there is we need to make it easier. We need to, you know, increase our distance or we need to change something else about the situation so that the dog is calmer. And I think that feels sometimes more counterintuitive to people because it feels like, well, but I'm, you know, we need to make progress, right? Like we got to kind of push the envelope or the dog's never going to get better. And, you know, that's true to a point. We do need to increase the difficulty level as we go. But the truth is that you'll actually make much faster progress by backing off and making it easier and working with your dog when they're really, truly under threshold. They're really calm and relaxed and able to take treats and it's easy for them. And then working up the difficulty level from there, rather than constantly trying to work them in the state where they're able to take treats and they're kind of holding it together, but they're not really in a great place emotionally. So, and again, sometimes that's a little bit hard to sort out on your own, especially if you're not entirely sure what you're looking for in terms of body language. So again, if you're having trouble, you think that might be your issue, totally worth it to find a good trainer to work with at least for a few sessions who can get you pointed in the right direction and help you see some of those things that you might have trouble seeing. So what are some good places to work on your own, right? Because I know it's all well and good to say, well, you know, controlled training sessions with a trainer are really the best way to go. And of course, that's true to the extent that you can do that, absolutely. But we know that you're going to make a lot quicker progress if you're able to do some practice on your own in between sessions. And we know that, you know, for some dog owners out there, there just may not be anybody all that close to you who is able to help. So regardless of whether you are working with a trainer and you just need some extra practice in between, or if you don't have anybody nearby who can help you, there are definitely some places you can go to work on your own if your dog's not able to handle sort of normal walks in your neighborhood at this point. So some of the places that I often have my clients go to practice are places like if your dog is reactive to people specifically, you can do something like go to a local, you know, grocery store or something like that and park, you know, way at the end of the parking lot, you know, as far away from the building as you can get. And then you can just get out if you want to and stand beside your car, you know, and practice marking and rewarding your dog for looking at people, just like we talked about. And the advantage of going someplace like this is that you know there will be a good, pretty steady stream of people that you can use to practice, but they're people who are going to be in a pretty predictable location. You know, they're going to be kind of walking back and forth in this general area to their cars. And you can control the distance away from them. So that's really important. So that's why I like, you know, grocery stores or other types of businesses that have a pretty, you know, steady flow of people coming in and out because it's pretty predictable and it's something that you can really control, you know, where you want to be in relation to the people, which often is really different from going for a walk in your neighborhood, right? Where you might have a neighbor, you know, come out of their house right as you walk by, or you may look up and turn a corner and somebody's rounding the corner right in front of you with their dog on a leash. So things like that. If your dog specifically has trouble with other dogs, you can do that same thing, but go to, you know, someplace like Petco or PetSmart, where oftentimes people do bring dogs in and out. So same thing, you can park way at the far end of the parking lot so that you have plenty of distance and you can practice, you know, just hang out and wait for people to walk in or out with their dogs and practice, you know, marking and rewarding your dog for looking at them. You could also look at using a training class to your advantage in some way, and whether this is an option for you or not is going to depend a little bit on, you know, how sensitive your dog is. But for example, you might be able to do something like, you know, sign up for some kind of class and then not come with the goal of participating in the class, but come with the goal of maybe sitting, you know, in the corner far away from the other dogs and just letting your dog practice looking at the dogs and getting cookies and maybe only staying for 10 or 15 minutes and then leaving, for example. And a lot of times if you talk to the instructor of the class, obviously you'd want to do that beforehand and kind of let them know what you're trying to do. you know, oftentimes you can work something out as far as, you know, what the charge would be for that. Or, you know, basically you're just using the other dogs as a, you know, a predictable source of, you know, something that you can use to practice with your dog rather than taking the class to do the class stuff. Or if that's too much for your dog, you know, you can sometimes go to the training class around the time when people are getting there for a class and, you know, practice again, parking at the far end of the parking lot and just watching people come in and out. And a lot of times if you talk to the instructor of the class, they may have some ideas for you as well. So now let's switch gears a little bit and talk about dogs who are leash reactive, who are not fearful, right? So like I said, in my experience, most of the dogs I see for this issue are fearful, at least to some extent, and that's their main problem. But it wouldn't be a really sort of thorough discussion about this problem if we didn't take a little bit of time to talk about dogs who have almost the opposite problem. So there definitely is a subset of dogs who go crazy and bark and lunge and act really obnoxious on the leash, not because they're afraid of, usually it's other dogs that this is directed at, but occasionally we see it with dogs who just get this excited about people. But essentially the problem is the dog is just so excited to see another dog and they want to go and say hi and they can't because they're on leash. And so they get really frustrated and wound up and you get, you know, these really obnoxious displays related to that. So a lot of trainers will call these dogs frustrated greeters. And many of them, at least the ones that I've seen, have been, you know, like think about your typical sort of 12-month-old like Labrador retriever that has lots of energy and, you know, is really excited about the whole world and really loves other dogs and or people. And they just cannot even handle the fact that they're on a leash and they can't immediately run up to everybody they see and say hi. So instead you get the barking, the lunging, that you may still get hackles up. You may get some body language that's a little bit hard to read or can be confused for, you know, fear or aggression, but it's more rooted in just excitement and frustration. And I will say that it's not always as clear cut as you might think either. There definitely are dogs who have kind of conflicting motivations, you know, who are interested and they kind of want to say hi, but they're kind of nervous also about it and not really sure what they think. So sometimes you can get kind of mixed body language, you know, dogs that in some ways look friendly and excited, but in other ways look kind of fearful and not happy. And we can also see sometimes that this behavior can evolve more towards aggression over time, because there actually is a pretty fine line between arousal that is related to excitement and arousal that is related to, you know, frustration and less friendly emotions, basically. So we definitely can see dogs who start out as friendly, frustrated greeters and then become more aggressive over time as a result of being frustrated. And often also as a result of, you know, sometimes owners try to handle this with different types of punishment, like we alluded to before, like if you're trying to fix this problem with, you know, leash corrections with a prong collar or a shock collar, something like that. That's where you can get a lot of this conflicted behavior where now the dog is still really wound up and excited, but also they're kind of not sure what they think and kind of not happy about it because they've associated bad things sometimes with seeing other dogs or people in the past. So you can get this kind of mishmash, you know, really conflicted looking behavior. So fortunately, it doesn't make a huge difference to us in terms of treatment, you know, which of these categories we think a dog falls into. And that's good because, like I said, a lot of times it's not clear cut. I've definitely seen some dogs who were just pretty clear cut frustrated greeters, but I've also seen a lot of dogs who were really conflicted in their body language. And yes, they were kind of being friendly and wanting to say hi, but they were also, you know, showing some you know, body language and some types of behavior that I would not classify as entirely friendly. So oftentimes it's not as nice and neat as just saying, oh, this dog is, you know, fearful, or this dog is just excited and wants to say hi. So treatment very much the same. We still treat these guys the same way. But probably the only major difference for me, at least, is if I'm pretty sure that the dog seems more just, you know, kind of excited and frustrated versus fearful or aggressive, we tend to put more emphasis on really getting that alternative behavior, you know, so really focusing on, can you look at me and get treats? Because for these dogs, you know, if their body language is pretty clear cut and they really seem mostly friendly and excited, you know, it's not doing us as much good just to associate you know, treats with the other dogs, right? So the step where we're saying, oh, you know, look at this dog and get a treat, that's still useful to us because that's what prompts the behavior of, you know, what we want is that chain of see the other dog, choose to look at the handler, and then get a treat. So just feeding the dog for seeing other dogs is still the first step there, but we care less about the classical conditioning aspect in this case, if that makes sense. So that's really the biggest difference. I'm in a little bit more of a hurry to start seeing, you know, I really want to see that dog, that head turn, you know, that dog, I'm choosing to look at the other dog and then look back at the handler and get a reward. For some of these dogs, they also seem to do better if we focus more on teaching them some other obedience behaviors that they can do so that once they see the dog, they look back at their handler instead of just doing a lot of look at the dog, look back, look at the dog, look back, which is a lot of what we do with our fearful dogs. For these dogs, we may look more at, you know, okay, now that you've acknowledged the dog, looked back at your handler, you know, can you sit? Can you lay down? Can you heel a few steps? Can you do a hand touch? Things like that. So we focus more on, you know, can you choose to do stuff with your handler and get rewards for that in the presence of another dog, even if the other dog's really far away, versus, you know, focusing so much on just rewarding the dog for seeing the other dog. But really, like I said, it's not that much different. And for a lot of dogs, it's, you can't really put them into a really clear category regardless. So, you know, we start all of them out the same way. And then, you know, how much emphasis we put on, you know, just seeing the other dog and taking treats versus asking the dog to do some other types of obedience behaviors just depends a little bit on how things go. So as long as things are going well, we can gradually work on moving closer to the other dog. And it depends what our goals are. You know, if our goal is to actually arrange a greeting, you know, we can often work on teaching these guys some more polite, calm greeting behaviors too, if that's something that the owner's interested in. So one common question that I get about these dogs, and it does seem like an obvious question, right? I totally get it. Is, well, you know, if he's just really excited and frustrated and wants to say hi, and that's why he's doing this, can't we just let him go say hi to the other dog, right, and get it over with, and then things will be fine? So, unfortunately, that is not as great an idea as it initially seems like it might be, for a couple of reasons. So, one is that if we allow our dog, who is, you know, barking and shrieking and hitting the end of the leash like a crazy dog, to then immediately run over and say hi to the dog that he's excited about, we have really just reinforced that behavior, right? You know, we've taught our dog that, hey, if you want to say hi to that dog over there, here's how you do it, right? You know, you just act as obnoxious as you possibly can, and the more obnoxious you are, the faster your handler will run you over to that dog to say hello. So, not what we want to see. And, you know, it is important to realize, here's my little caveat about that, that these kinds of behaviors, they are largely emotionally driven, you know, so we care a lot about manipulating the dog's emotional state, and I generally care less about, you know, whether we're rewarding the behavior or not. I especially don't care about that if we're, like, giving food to a fearful dog that's barking and growling, because we know that to a large extent, these kinds of behaviors are not things that the dog is, you know, making a conscious choice to do. In the same way that they might choose to sit or choose to lay down for a treat, they're things that are reflections of the emotion that the dog's having. So that's why, you know, a lot of times we don't tend to focus as much on, you know, rewarding or punishing the behavior. We care about the emotion. But in this case, there is certainly something to be said for the idea that dogs can absolutely learn, you know, that leaping at their leash and getting hysterical and obnoxious is a successful strategy, you know, for getting them what they want, which in this case is to go say hi to the other dog. So as tempting as it might be to do that, because it's a quick, easy way to get your dog to stop doing the thing that he's doing, not recommended for that reason. The other reason that I'm not a fan of this approach, especially with dogs that have really any degree of conflict in their behavior, is that if you let your, you know, shrieking, obnoxious, over-the-top dog rush right up to another dog to say hi, very, very often that greeting is not going to go well, right? Because even if your dog has friendly intentions, the other dog, you know, is minding its own business and sees your dog just barreling towards them, right? You know, just shrieking and barking and being super crazy. So the other dog's probably not going to appreciate that, right? Just like if you were, you know, in a public place and some, you know, overly friendly, you know, drunk person or something came running up to you and was like, hi, how are you? It's great to meet you, and throws their arms around you and all these things, right? Even though they're being friendly, what they're doing is really socially inappropriate and makes you feel threatened, right? You know, so certainly most of us would not appreciate that kind of approach from a stranger in a public place, and dogs don't either. So very often the other dog is going to react poorly to that. And your dog, even if they didn't come over there with sort of the intention of being aggressive, dogs that are that worked up and highly aroused, it doesn't take much to kind of tip them over the edge from being excited and happy to being wound up and aggressive. So those types of greetings can turn into fights really quickly. Even if, you know, your dog initially was being friendly and the other dog initially wasn't being aggressive, it can go badly. So that's another probably even more important reason that I don't recommend just letting your dog who's doing this just run up to the other dog and say hi. So for dogs that do have that issue, it does seem to help some of them if you can find ways for them to get some opportunities to socialize with other dogs and, you know, do off-leash play and things if that's something that they like, you know, whether that means setting up play dates with other dogs you know that, you know, that they get along well with, or dog parks are controversial. You know, and actually I'm planning on doing an episode about dog parks in general at some point in the future, because I think, again, there's a lot to say about that. But, you know, some dogs do well with dog parks, and if your dog likes that and you have a pretty safe, well-controlled dog park to go to, that could be an option. Just anything that gives them a chance to actually see and be around other dogs in an appropriate way can sometimes help to take the edge off of this too, because some of these dogs are kind of prone to act like this because they just never get a chance to interact with other dogs. So, you know, when they see another dog on a walk, it's super novel and exciting. And, you know, so of course they're really wound up and want to go say hi. So sometimes it does help to basically help them find some other outlets for their, you know, their interest in being social. The other thing is I don't typically allow really dogs in general, but especially dogs like this, to do unleash greetings at all. Because ideally, we just don't want them to expect that, right? When they are out on a walk and they see another dog across the street being walked by its owner, we don't want these dogs to expect that they're going to be allowed to greet and, you know, play or do anything exciting like that. We want the other dog to just be kind of part of the background. Like, yep, it's another dog. You saw it. Good job. Here's a treat. Now come with me. We're going to heal. We're going to, you know, we're going to do some hand touches. We're going to do something else. Because that'll help take the edge off of that too. If you do, you know, decide for whatever reason occasionally to allow an off-leash greeting, keep it really short. A lot of dog trainers use the 3-second rule for on-leash greetings, and I think it's a good one, which basically means if you're going to let your dog say hi to another dog on leash, you know, count 3 seconds in your head. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. Okay, let's go. Because that's plenty. That's more than enough time for a quick polite butt sniff or, you know, whatever they want to do. Not enough time, hopefully, for them to get into any trouble. There is a line of thinking that a lot of the problems we see between dogs during on-leash greetings are a result of them kind of staying near each other longer than they would normally want to and not having a way to sort of leave the situation after they've said their polite hello because their handlers have both stopped walking and they're both on leash. So it does seem to cut down on a lot of those problems if you just, you know, let your dog have a quick sniff if that's what you choose to do, but then just keep walking. So I hope that some of that at least has been helpful for you guys today. I do think this is a really interesting topic and one that comes up a ton in real life. I think, you know, like I said, it's one of the most common things that I see clients for. So hopefully some nuggets there that you can put to use if you're having this problem with your dog. So as always, if you are enjoying the podcast, feel free to swing by on iTunes, leave a rating or a review. That's always helpful. You know, I'm always interested to see what people have to say, but also it does help other people find it, which is good. And of course, if you want to get in touch with me for any reason, if you have questions or comments, or if you have topic suggestions that you'd like to hear me cover, I'm always interested in that as well. You can email me at jen@drjensdogblog.com, or you can go to my website, Dr. Jen's Dog Blog, and there's a contact form there you can use if you prefer.